Our reading tonight is from the book of Genesis, and we'll commence to read in chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11,
just for a short little reading here. Verse 27 of Genesis 11. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abraham, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran begat Lot. Verse 31, and Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan, and they came unto Haran and dwelt there. You just notice verse 28, before we leave that, and Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. Now over to chapter 13.
Of Genesis chapter 13. This is Abraham coming back from Egypt in verse 4 onto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord, and Lot also which went with Abram had flocks and herds and tents. And the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great,
so that they could not dwell together. And there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle,
and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwell then in the land. And Abram said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes, and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. And Abraham dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, verse 18, then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. Now, chapter 14, this is the invasion of the kings, verse 11, and they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals, and went their way, and they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And then we have Abraham rescuing Lot. Now just a little reading in chapter 19, I'll not read much here, for we know it well. Chapter 19 and verse 1, and there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, and Lot seeing them rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face to the ground. Now, the whole story is known, but I read at the end of the chapter, verse 30. And Lot went up out of Zoar, and dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar. And he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. Verse 37, and the firstborn bare a son, and called his name Moab, the same as the father of the Moabites unto this day. And the younger, she also bare a son, and called his name Ben-Ammi, the same as the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. Now, that will keep us supplied with more than enough material for our considerations tonight. We trust the Lord will bless his word. This is really the night to which I wasn't looking forward. It has come, and we'll have to face it. Indeed, it's the night that I might have skipped had I been given a choice. We're talking about choice. I didn't want to avoid the night because I knew the numbers would be smaller. That's not the point at all. Tonight is different. Well, those were good choices, weren't they? the sovereign choice of God. Whatever God chose was perfect and profitable. The superior choice of Mary. The consequences of that choice are written over parts of the New Testament. She chose well. It was delightful to look at that. The supreme choice of Moses. He counted the values. And he had a clear vision. And he had a courageous valor. And he said no to Egypt. And he won a complete victory. Moses' choice was a good one. Mary's choice was a good one. God's choice, obviously, was a good one. But tonight, things are going the other way. Then, Lot chose. If ever there was a critical choice, if ever a critical choice had painful consequences, it was just right there. We'll go to talk with Lot for a minute in the cave. There he is languishing in his carnality. Unfortunately, the infants of incest at his feet. Confined in his little cave. You would never dream that there was a day when he was one of the greatest farmers in Canaan. So big, so prosperous, that the land wouldn't even hold him. Now it just takes a cave to hold him. It's big enough. Indeed, it's too big for some of the antics that he got up to. You have a chat with him. You say, well now, Lot, I hear that things used to be different with you. Oh, he said, don't talk. Different. Don't talk. Well, Lot, I don't want to take you over the ground, but could you even give me a clue what happened? I said, I tell you. He says, there was one day in my life, he said, and I made a choice. And he said, all the sorrows that have pained my life since, and there have been hardly any days without them, he said, all those sorrows are attributable to that one choice. And back again, really what we've been talking about a good little bit throughout these meetings, dear brethren and sisters, the choices that we make in life can have an amazing influence upon our future. Someone has said that life is not the dreams that we dream, but real life is the sum total of the choices that we make. You know, if all our dreams were realities, we would be super Christians. But we are not what we could be, we are not what we should be, we are not what we might be, just because of the choices. Lot's sad, secular choice. I wish I could finish and call it a day and say we'll not make any more because it's no point looking at this and it doesn't really matter and it doesn't really affect us and it doesn't have any bearing. The man made a blunder, but we never do it. So there's no point looking at it. It'll only distress us, and in a way, it's not like it. No, I suppose. We are more likely to make Lot's choice than we are to make Moses' choice. We are more likely to follow the preference of Lot than we are to follow the preference of Mary. And it's because it's just such a tremendous likelihood that we take a good close to see if we can warn ourselves before we get too far over the edge. Let me quote, read a thing here. I have it, that's why I have this piece of paper. Tozer. Tell me what you think of this. The man or woman who is wholly and joyously surrendered to Christ can't make a wrong choice. Any choice will be the right one. Tozer was 100% right. Let me read it again. And if I had just one statement, it's a borrowed statement, as I told you. If I just had one statement that I would love to be remembered from these meetings, and I hope that I remember it myself, it's this. The man or woman, the middle part of the sentence is the operative little section. The man or woman who is a Christian can't make, no. Christians, sure to give. The man or woman who is holy and joyously surrendered to Christ can't make a wrong choice. Any choice will be the right one. That is, when I make a wrong choice, it's because of my selfish preference. When I make a wrong choice, it's really the fruit of my un-Christ-like cravings. But I say again, Tozer was right. The man or woman who is wholly and joyously surrendered to Christ can't make a wrong choice. And give me that man and woman, and I will tell you, whatever that man or woman is exactly the same as Christ is here. So that if I want to be in a position to have the right perspective on life, to claim the right priorities, to choose the right path, and to move for the right preferences, the only secret is for me to give myself totally to Christ. Mind, emotions, will, body, soul, and spirit. And to hold absolutely nothing in reserve. Well, having left that, I wanted to make something positive tonight. Having said that, I want to go through, I think I'll divide the subject into six, or maybe five. I'll try and contain it in five. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I don't often do that, because there are a couple of reasons. If you tell people what you're going to do, and you get to 10 to 9, and you've only the first 2 points covered, and you have 6 to go, they get very uncomfortable. So I usually don't tell them. And then if you tell them what you're going to do, and you don't finish it, well then, you've nearly ruined the half for another sermon. So, because you've let the cat out of the bag. But I'm going to let the whole cat out just now. I want to think about the character. The character who made this choice. Then, Lot chose. Then I want to say a little bit about the circumstances that surrounded this choice. Thirdly, I'll say a little bit about the criteria that determined this choice. What it was, what considerations made him go that way, the criteria that determined. I want to think then about some of the changes that accompanied that choice. And we'll spend perhaps a while at the end of the meeting thinking about some of the calamities that followed that choice. Now, someone has said, to go back to the first point, the character who made the choice. You know, there's scarcely anything reveals our character like our choices. When I make a choice, I'm really giving people, by the choice that I make, and the route that I follow, I'm giving people a window into my soul. Because when I take a certain avenue, and when I opt for a certain alternative, I'm letting people see what it is that really makes me tick. What it is that I really want. What it is that I really value. Where my preferences and priorities and predilections really lie. When I make a choice, I'm showing that. So that a choice,
A choice is something that springs from the interior. Now, many of our choices are to do with external things, but a choice, it actually springs from the interior of our being, and it manifests our character. So that our choices are very, very important. They're saying a lot about ourselves. Now, this man, we can't obviously tonight, in this one segment of a meeting, we can't go into all the details of his whole life, but just, I'm not saying this out of sympathy. You see, if I were a psychologist just now, I would probably take a different view of all this. Because this could be explained, and this could be washed away by some sort of psychology. You see, if we go back to a first mention of Lot, you know that he was a son of a man called Haran, a brother of Abraham. Now, before they ever left Haran, before they ever left Ur, his father died. Haran died. Right? I couldn't just tell you, the passage doesn't tell us. I couldn't tell you what age Lot was when his father died. But his two uncles were still living. So presumably, Lot's father died when he was a relatively young man. Now, the death of a father figure in the ancient world was quite a blow, as it still is to the present day, but not nearly so much as it was in the ancient world. The father figure, he was the counselor, he was the guide, he was the chief of the whole family, and the whole family depended upon him. And now, Lot's father is gone. Now, that meant that Lot latched onto his uncle Abram, so that he became, it would appear now, from early life, reasonably early life, Lot became a dependent kind of a character. Now that's important. Then the Bible tells us after a while, not only did he lose his father, but his grandfather died. And of course the old grandfather was the patriarch of the whole tribe. And when the old grandfather died, that was another loss. So that this boy Lot, he now lost his father, he's lost his grandfather, and he becomes more closely attached and emotionally dependent more than ever upon Uncle Abel. When Uncle Abram comes into the land of Canaan, the Bible tells us who he came to. He was a Christian already. He was a Christian. The Bible says he was a righteous man. But he came along with Uncle Abel. He never worried, but Uncle Abel's going to must be all right. Then, of course, Uncle Abram, he got off the tracks a wee bit too. And he went away, but not just he just went away. Uncle Abram got recovered. He came back up. And he came back to the altar. And the Bible tells us here, I'm right now into chapter 13, it says, Lot also which went with Abram. Now, I think that's a very, very significant little attachment. Lot also which went with Abraham. I don't want to be too hard on him, but it nearly seems to me as if he was tagging along. Abraham was the man that really knew God. You never read of Lot building an altar. So long as Uncle Abram built an altar in the whole community of the whole family, if Uncle Abram built the altar, let him do it and let him stay and get on. He'd look after all the rest of us. But he'd go along with it. He doesn't seem to have any real, definite, personal, individual, rich experience with God, but he's cruising along on Uncle Abram's deep experience. Now that did good for a while, but that was fine for a while until there came a crisis. And the man who was hiding along, and the man who was a floating personality, really being carried by the stronger figure of his spiritual uncle, when he had to stand on his own feet, he just buckled at the knee. Now, the psychologist, of course, would say, well, you know, Judy Thomas, too hard on Turkey. Fella didn't have a chance. He had these two bereavements. And like, he was just got it tough enough. And he didn't get a great start in life, for sure. What better can you expect? What better can you expect? Of course, the Bible doesn't allow us that excuse. The Bible can tell me about men, I'll not go through it now. The Bible can tell me about men that had just as poor a start as Lot had, and they shone for God. You know, we should never blame our poor performance upon our ancestors, or our circumstances, or the difficulties. That is absolutely no excuse. And I'm speaking, I see quite a number of young folks here tonight, even with the smaller meeting, even with that, and I'll say to you, it's great to know older men. It's great to stay in the company of spiritual giants if you can find them. That's great. That's great. But listen, whatever you do, don't you think that their experience will carry you through life? Just don't you be going along. Now, younger folks, let me tell you, don't you just come to the meetings because your uncle called. Young ladies here, don't you just come into the assembly because your granny's there. If we are going to be able to stand and to make the right choices, we cannot have dependent characters like Lot. We have to have people that know why they are, where they are, what they are, and know exactly what they're walking in. And they're not just tagging along. And they're not just floating personalities. Now that's the character. I say nothing more about that. That's the character. Then Lot chose. Actually, for younger believers here, I might say this is another line of things now altogether. I'm not going into it tonight, but you follow it through. There's a close parallel between these chapters and what takes place later on in the book of Exodus. What happens to Abraham and then what happens to the nation. Now just let me give you a couple of wee quick parallels and you follow them out. They're quite amazing if you follow them. Abraham had a famine going down into Egypt. The children of Israel, the family of Jacob, had a famine. They went down into Egypt. When Abraham got down into Egypt, God plagued Pharaoh. When the children of Israel, because of a famine, got down into Egypt, God plagued Pharaoh. After God plagued Pharaoh, Pharaoh called Abraham. He says, you better get out of here. And when he was going out, Pharaoh gave Abraham all kinds of wealth. When God plagued the children of Israel, Pharaoh, in the days of Moses, Pharaoh said to Moses, look, get these people out. And the Bible tells us when the children of Israel were going out of Egypt, that the Egyptians laid them down with wealth. So what happened to Father Abraham happened to his seed. Now, when the children of Israel were coming out of Egypt, who came with them? Isn't there a bunch of people in the book of Exodus called a mixed multitude? Sort of hangers-on. Hangers-on. And when that house hangers-on got out into the wilderness, they joined the group that was moving, but when they got out into the wilderness, they couldn't stick the manna, and they didn't like the water, and they wanted to go back. That's it. You know, that's just like that. He couldn't stick the faces, he couldn't stick the path, and when Lot got out of Egypt with Uncle Abraham, he eventually had to go back, because he was just like your next multitude. My point here is, for your character, because it's character that enables a person to make choices. You see, it's hard for me to... I'll ask you a question. Is it my character makes the choices? Or is it my choices make my character? Which is it? I think the answer is both. Because my character, I make choices, then the choices that I make, they form more character, or they deform character, as the case may be. And you need to form your own convictions, and have your own and be willing to stand in your own feet. Now the circumstances, that's the character that made the choice. The circumstances that surrounded the choice. Difficulty to hear that. There were two things. And I don't want to stay long at this, but just let me mention these two things. Substance. Strife. That's what chapter 13 tells us. Chapter 13 tells us that Abraham was very wealthy. It tells us Lot was very wealthy. And both men had great substance. Between the herd men, there broke out strife. Because of that substance and because of that strife, poor Lot got derailed. And he made this wrong choice. Now when all this bickering broke out amongst the herd men, and you can be pretty sure it wasn't too kindly, because when people start to get jealous over things, and they start to fight over things, well, I tell you, there can be some very catty things said. And there can be some very, very cruel things done. And there was quite an uproar. And the Perizzites and the Canaanites, I'll not go into that, there was quite an uproar. And Abraham, the spiritual man, he couldn't bear this. And he said, this will have to be settled. Let there be no strife, for we be brethren. And Lot didn't like it. He just couldn't take it. And then Lot chose. Then. Now, I'm not amongst the ancients, as you know, but I'll say this. In my short little time amongst the Lord's people, I have seen quite a number of Christians get off the track because of two things. Substance. Strength. I have seen many a man, well, I'm not saying many a man, I don't want to exaggerate, I've certainly seen a few men. And I saw them coming into the assembly, taking an interest in the things of God. They got promotion at their work, they did well, and money went to their heads and they became useless here. Substance. And they had to make a choice. Am I going to rise here, or am I going to climb there? And for some reason or other, I couldn't tell you just exactly where the choice was made, or when the choice was made, but I have seen the evidence of it. They have become massive men in business. And they become miniature men in the Bible. And they must have made a choice. Substance. The other thing, maybe nearly worse. I've seen many people that did well in assembly life until trouble broke out. I can say, I'll whisper into your ear, brethren and sisters, and if I'm tested, you likely hear that I make the same blunder. Do you see when there's strife in the assembly? Don't move too quickly. Don't jump. Don't overreact. Take it easy. Because if people make choices in the middle of strife, it's not always true. But very often they turn out to be the wrong choices. So I appeal to you all, you know the old proverb that says, when stormy seas are raging, it's not the time to change ships. No, no. When the thing, wait until the thing calms. If there's going to be anything done or moves made, wait until the thing calms. Now, in the midst of substance and in the midst of strife, then chose Lot. And that'll be enough for the circumstances. What about the criteria? The character that made the choice, the circumstances that surrounded the choice. Now, just for a minute or two, the criteria that dictated the choice. Now, this is maybe getting, I'm getting now to the very, right to the choice itself. When the choice had to be made, it doesn't matter who's making it, and it doesn't matter why and where and when he's making it. Now we're at the very point where the choice is actually being made, and what are the factors that are going to influence the decision? Well, they're very simple. Look what it says in verse number 10. It says, Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, and so on. Then Lot chose him and journeyed east. So that here's a man made a choice just by this. It was what he saw. He lifted up his eyes and he beheld. Now at this particular time, and again I'm not going into the whole of Genesis 13 or anything like it, but at this particular time, these men were standing up on the ridge of Bethel, the central upper lands of the land of Palestine. They were about 2,000 feet and a little more above sea level. When they looked up there, it was very rugged stuff. When they looked over here, it was still a bit bumpy. When they looked back here, it was rocky again and tapering out. Well, I tell you, boys, it's here when they looked over here, down just to the southeast. Oh, I tell you, that nearly, oh, lot, his eyes popped out onto his cheeks. He says, look at, he saw a pound note. A pound note sign on every blade of grass. Or maybe it was a Canaanite euro. I don't know exactly what it was. But he saw big stocks, and he saw increasing herd, and he saw unlimited prosperity. He lifted up his eyes, and he said, that's it. So he said, my choice is going to be dictated by what I see and by what is material and what is natural. What smacks of earthly prosperity, what seems to guarantee worldly greatness, he says, that's what I'm going to opt for. He says, see you later, Uncle Abraham. Now, just let me stop here for a minute or two. Is it not true, brethren and sisters, that a great many of our choices are dictated by just the same kind of things? What smacks of earthly prosperity, what seems to guarantee worldly greatness, he said, that's what I'm going to opt for. He says, see you later, Uncle Abraham. Now, just let me stop here for a minute or two. Is it not true, brethren and sisters, that a great many of our choices are dictated by just the same kind of things? You know, the world, the society in which we live and have to make our decisions for God, it's a society that is very, 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 very much governed by sight. You get a fella, you know what sight, female fashion and female form. You know what has been projected by the world as the perfect female. Then you get a Christian law. And just purely on the basis of sight, with a bit of poise and paint and powder and polish, he will choose a girl, because instead of being guided by a deeper spirit, now I'm not saying you don't use sight, you don't want to make a jump in the dark and suffer from eye strain the rest of your life, or anything like that. I'm still living in land earth and all that. I'm not saying that, but you see, he just takes the world standards, and the glitz and the glamour. You take a house, you know what they want, and a car. The power and the seat material and the gadgetry and the gimmick, it's all sight and this material. And I wonder if in our Christianity we haven't dropped down to the level of the world in making our choices. Now I'm going to talk about TV. Don't get on your trouble, right? TV. We're living in the age of that. 50 years has made a tremendous change in Great Britain. That was the catalyst for TV becoming common. And I'm not here to scold if a Christian has a TV. If you have a TV in your house, that's your own business. And that most of the people that don't scold about you having it, they have got there on the internet in their house. And the internet's every bit as bad as TV. You see this business talking about TV, you shouldn't have a TV. And you see the preaching that we did, brother, I'll be honest. You see the preaching that we did, that if you didn't have a TV, you could have anything in your spirit. As long as you hadn't a TV, you were spiritual. That preaching's, that's threadbare. That's useless. We have to live in the age that we're in, the age of the video and the multimedia. And we've all been linked up sooner or later to TVs and transistors and internet and so on and so forth. Now the point is this. I'm not so much worried about the TV in itself. It's a symptom. It's only a symptom. We want to take a look at the society that has produced it, and the society that's fascinated by it. Because behind that symptom, there must be a far, far deeper sickness. And if we can get beyond the symptoms...
50 years ago, 1952 or 53, whatever it was the turning point. TVs in the 40s in the British Isles were quite rare. Maybe a house in 10 had it. But after the coronation of the Queen, people suddenly, it suddenly dawned on people, do you know you could see the Queen getting crowned in your own room? We could see her getting crowned in her own living room, and the thing went wild. Now, the average British person spends 20 hours a week watching TV. That's the average, not with another. That's nearly a day a week out. So that in 50 years, there has been a strange move because we become fascinated by... I read a very interesting article. I better keep moving now. Because I think, you see all that extra stuff last night, I think the people are taking cold feet and straightening the life out of them. So I have to pack up and find the ring. I read an interesting article a short time ago. It's a book was written by a Christian man, well written on a number of subjects, but he was talking about this very line of things, and he took the word video, an acronym on the word video, and he talked about the society in which we are found. Now he said the first thing about our society is it's a society that is guided and governed by the visual. The visual. Image. Presentation. You know the lens on the camera can deceive. And on the screen they can cut a thing short. They don't let you see the real truth of it. They can exaggerate a thing, they can elongate a thing, they can snap it up, they can do anything, but as long as it's a good image and colourful and forceful and you really get the people. Yes, you see, we're in a society, friend, where people are absolutely bowled over by the visual. The night I trusted Christ, I joined the community of the unseen. An unseen Christ, and an unseen eternity, and an unseen heaven, those became the realities in my life, and the visual, and the vanity. God expects it never to mean the same again. That's what he did. That's what he did. He said, today, do you think of taking a look at this tree? Oh, she saw the tree was pleasant to the eye. Tree to be desired, to make one wise. The eyes, the emotions, the intelligence. But the eyes. It says that Lot looked out over this lovely, lush lane lying down to the southeast, and he said, oh, he said, it's just like the Garden of Eden. Lot seemed to forget that the Garden of Eden wasn't even safe. Because there was a visitor who came to the Garden of Eden and brought the whole thing to ruin. You know, not everything that's nice in this world of image, not everything that's nice is the visual. The second thing that marks this age is the society and the sickness. Is not only the craving for the visual, but the delight in the instant. The instant. You see, it used to be if something happened over there in New Zealand, you had to wait a couple of days to hear about it or see it. And if you get a thing through, or back in the 1950s, when the Olympic Games were being held in Vancouver, it was 2 hours before the people over here got the result. Not now. As soon as the boy hits the ball, you can see him doing it. As soon as the planes go into the tower, people thought it was a film, and they were watching, but they could see it actually happen. It was right now. You can see it now. And it gives the impression, you need to be up to date, and you need to be in the now, and you need to know exactly what's happening now, at every moment, everywhere in the world. And TV, and all that goes with it, internet and all that, all that goes with it. It has made people the slaves of the present, the now, the instant. Then he took up the word, the letter D, the distant. The distant. Now this is a very far-reaching thing. So that people can watch violence. Violence in Sri Lanka. Violence in Africa. They can watch films with bloodshed and people murdering each other in the most violent manner. And they can sit in their living room and watch it and say, that's all right, because nowhere near me. It's just in the box. But of course they can also watch Vice. And they can sit in the box and they can watch things on the box and see places that they wouldn't dare to go to in real life. But stories. I'm well aware of it. Listen, dear brother. Listen. Listen. People think that they can watch on the screen what is distant and say, oh, it's far away. And listen, that's the problem. They see it there. The government allows things to be shown there, and they think that what we show on the screen will entertain people. What is on the screen tonight is on the street tomorrow. Because what seems to be distant comes right here. You can't, and I was thinking about a Christian now. I don't know, see, all of us here, not just TV, internet. You can visit strange places. Remember what you watch on the screen now. And it seems far away, it could be in your own life in a very, very short time. E, I better stop with this. Entertainment, entertainment. Everything's entertaining. Don't keep anybody. You don't keep anybody concentrated. See, that's what has made preaching difficult. Because a man gets up with his Bible and he speaks, you hope for 40 minutes, and if he can't get stopped, he'll go for 45. And he just preaches, and is preaching and preaching, and people have to sit and think and concentrate, and we are producing, even Christians sometimes, we are producing an audience of Christians, and if you give any kind of a reason to dress, that's the same as you, because we have produced a generation, and about 3.5 seconds is the screen time. That's the change. That's the change. That's the change. Flash. Sensational. Change. Variety. Anything that's prolonged or extended or demanding or requiring concentration. No, entertain us. Entertain us. Make it colorful. Make it changing. You see, the visual, the instant, the distant, the entertaining, and then the old. He said, the big thing that this comes very close to what we are. The other things I hope are close enough as well. The optional. 40 years ago, they had two channels. You may think I know a bit about this television thing. Well, I do, sure. They told somewhere lately that I was recommending it. So I don't think you'll just say that I'm recommending it. But I'm not, I want to be more objective. I'm not just getting up to say, don't have a TV and all that. Listen, you may never see a TV and be as carnal a Christian as Walt Craig used to be. That's the point. That's I'm talking about a far, far bigger thing. They used to have three, what was it? ITV or something. BBC, I don't know what they are. Now they can sit cable, satellite, and they can sit with a thing. They wouldn't even have to get up in the chair. Just choose what you like. If you don't like a switch to another one, optional. Plenty of options. Plenty of choice. Don't keep us confined. Don't in any way limit us. Oh, we need to have the freedom of choice. Aye. You see, that's the word. It's not really that different from the world in which Lot lived. He saw. And by sight. Now, dear brother, dear sister, you watch that your choices are not dictated by sight. Very much of the, I saw a thing today. What was it? These magazines. This is the society. You know, the Good House magazine is in Good Housekeeping and Good Gardening and Good Health and Good This and Good That. And they're all glossy and colourful. And they're all a waste of money. I saw it being advertised today. Something like, what was it? 12 tips. 12 tips to keep you living young. Well, I think perhaps some people would need it, I suppose, and I wouldn't. They wouldn't need all the charm. And I tell some of you ladies, don't involve too much yourself, too much in those things, because when you have to stop them, you'll age about 35 years in 2 weeks. So just be very, very careful. Keep moving along steadily as the grace of God allows you to go. There's so many, and 6 tips that you can save an hour every day to use upon yourself. What about God then at all? If you get an extra, you then Lot chose him. Abram, you go where you like. Take to the hills, go to the rocks, go to the desert. I'm going to get this. It's for me. So by sight, and by secularism, and by selfishness, Lot made the choice. Oh, I tell you, isn't this a very, very, we need to watch this, don't we? These are the criteria that determine Lot's choice. And we need to watch that the same things wouldn't just affect our choice. What we see, what we feel, what we like, and all that. Because we're living in this society. Of course, there are other things brought in here. It was just like Egypt. It was just like the garden of God. Before the Lord destroys, oh, that's an awful ominous note. He looked upon his beauty. And the Bible says, but that was just before the Lord destroyed it all. Lot didn't look far enough ahead. I tell you this very same sight. It had a different look the morning the fire and brimstone fell. Dear brethren and sisters, do you see all this great big cosmetic work that has been garnished and painted and decorated and so beautifully presented? We need not get excited about it, for it'll soon be burning in the fire of God's judgment. And I tell you, it won't half melt, because there's an awful lot of plastic about it. May God help us to be people of reality. Far better to live with Abraham up on the hills of Hebron with your altar and enjoy peace and fellowship with God, than to live with poor Lot down in the green grass and the slime of Sodom and your heart vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. I was going to talk, and maybe I should, the calamities that followed this. It's heartbreaking. You know, in the next chapter, Lot loses his freedom. He becomes a captain. When the army came into Canaan, they didn't get Abraham. Abraham was a conqueror. But Lot became a captain. You get down into chapter 19, and not only the man in the conflict, that's chapter 14, but if you just give me a minute or two, and I'll just go through some of the things in my mind. Take the man in the city. He's lost his walk. He sits in the gate. He has lost his welcome. As soon as he tried to hold the men back at the door, the homosexuals hold them back at the door. They say, stand back. They said, where do you think you are? You came here as a visitor, and now you're going to be a judge. We don't want you at all. Listen, brother. The world will put up with you, but as soon as you start to challenge their sin, they would do the same with you as they did with Christ. They said, stand back! There they were, and they were very vociferous. The whole big shirt of old and young. You see, these sodomites, they're still vociferous. I was amazed. You hear about them in New York and Boston and so on. It's amazing to see a march of them down past the City Hall in Belfast. They were vociferous! And they were violent! They said, you don't get out of our road, we'll push you to death. And they were vile. Going to take his own daughters. Poor Lot, he had lost his welcome. He lost his weight. He lost his witness. Walked out the laughter. He lost his willingness to move for God. When the angel says, get out! Oh, he says, I can't go. He says, I want to go to the mountain. I don't want to go to the mountain. I was up there long enough with my uncle Abram, and I don't want to go back. They said, get out, because this place is going to be burned. He said, I don't want to move. Would you not let me go to the city? And he was as stubborn as a mule. The very smell of the sulfur wasn't enough to make him move for God. Brother, I don't know. You know, I just wonder at times, are we so much asleep? You can almost smell the sulfur that will soon be engulfing this sinful society. And may God help us to get a smell of it and live for nothing else. He became too, lost his willingness. He lost his wife. He lost his work. There's no gate left when that day was over. He lost his worship. He lost his wealth. The whole thing was burnt. And he climbed up into Zoar. A man that was absolutely penniless. I think when he was going through the city of Zoar and the sun was rising upon him. I wonder just as he looked across, as he looked across up the valley, up the hill. Oh, I says, remember the day I used to be there. Look where I am now. I admit it, I was going to talk about the changes that the Christ made. You know, he changed his level. Came from the mountain down to the plain. He changed his location. He got towards Sodom. You know all the sermons of the priesthood, looking toward it, pitching toward it, and living in it and so on. And he changed his links. He no longer had company with the good man. You know, I have noticed that when people start to take a materialistic choice in their Christian life, they generally speaking, they become less friendly with those who are spiritual. But, brother, do your best to company with a man more spiritual than yourself. And spiritual company will preserve you. When you're going down, it'll pull you up. You know, Lot only knew if he needed to stay close to Abraham. But he shouldn't have gone. He should have developed his own devotion with God and stayed under the shadow of the Spirit until he looked. What about him in the cave? He's lost his peace. He's afraid. He loses his propriety. Drunk. Imagine drunk. Lying drunk in a cave, a creature. I think he first learned a bit of social drinking down in Sodom. Younger people, watch the social drinking, because it's only a stage in a wrong road. He loses his purity, involved with his own daughter, and he leaves a posterity. Ammon and Moab. And you go away down the centuries, because I stop. You go away down the centuries, and you think about all the problems and the troubles that Ammonites and Moabites gave the children of Israel, and they just permitted them for centuries. And as you look at the centuries of bother, your mind comes back to three words. Then Lot chose. And centuries of sorrow hung upon the choice of one man. May God help us. Let our choices be activated by faith and trust in God. Let us, you know, Lot was a righteous man that had lost his pilgrim heart. May God give us a pilgrim heart like Abraham. So that as we sang last night, we'll be content to let the world go by, to know no gain or loss. Our sinful selves are only shame, our glory, oh, the cross. Watch, I'll read this and we'll stop. It's by a man, a preacher in Scotland, a man by the name of White, over 100 years ago. It's not a lengthy thing now. This is what he said in one of his sermons. I'll not read it all, actually. I have a little paragraph here. Think, fathers. Think, mothers. Think, young men. Think, young women. So much is at stake. Think what the temptations and the dangers and the issues of this and that choice in life must be. All our trades, professions, occupations in life have each one its own perils and temptations. Open your eyes. Count the cost. Are you able? Will you venture? Take that line of life which you are just about to choose. Take time over it. Look all around. Imagine yourself done with it. Look at this man and that man who are done with it. Would you like to be like them? Study well the successes and the failures in that line of life. This is his final statement. Read the 13th and the 19th chapters of Genesis.
take these two chapters with you to your knees. And then, make your choice. It's as serious as that. If we make a blunder, it's not that we haven't been warned. May God preserve us all, shall we pray. Our Father, we bow in the precious name of the Lord Jesus. We thank thee for the encouragements, the exhortations, the examples of thy word. We have also tonight been looking at one of the exhibitions, the serious warning, the sad case of this man, his secular choice dictated by sight and selfishness. We acknowledge that we have often fallen prey to similar temptations. Father, help us to have a greater appreciation of the heavenly than the earthly. Help us to stay closer to the eternal than to the temporal. Give us a firmer grasp on the spiritual rather than the material. Help us in all these things. Remember us as we leave the meeting. Burn these matters deeply into our souls. Help us to conduct our lives, to make the choices for our minutes and our days, so that when the time is past, we might not be filled with bitter regret, but be able to take the revenue of wise choices and lay them as trophies at the feet of the blessed Savior. We give thee thanks for him. He always made that wise choice, the perfect Son. We ask for grace to follow in his path as we commend our homeward journeys to thee in the precious name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.